to the idea that they were coming out of the Dark Ages, following the collapse of the Roman Empire. And so it was a time in some respects of some forward movement. And so what you're going to see tonight, you're going to see an emphasis on the art of the time and the architecture. And he'll do a pretty good job of pointing out that the art and the architecture will tell you what the philosophy and stuff of the time is. Now, there's a couple things in here that are a little bit inappropriate, it's because it's European art. If you've ever been to Europe, you have a good idea what we're talking about. Now, I would say this, it's no different than what's actually on the front of the Commonwealth of Virginia flag. Okay. So, if anybody here ever taken a close look at the Commonwealth of Virginia flag, or there? Okay. Okay, Lady Liberty is crushing the tyrant, okay? But she's dressed like one of the photos here tonight. So, there's just some things of an age past that are a little bit different for us today. So, there might be a spot or two where you want to, if you need to, cover little one's eyes. After we get through with this is, then I've got some comments that I want to make with regard to why this period of time is developing the way it is. Now, he just comments on how it's developing. He doesn't really get into why it does. And I have some information on why it does that I think you'll find interesting. Probably not surprising, but interesting. Let's see here. Probably your knee's in the way, Dan. Okay, come on. There we go.
Now we come to the Renaissance. It's one of the great periods of the history of man. And as far as its artworks are concerned, it's one of mankind's glories. Anyone who can walk through the museums and not be overwhelmed with the beauty of the work of its art in many, many different mediums really is a very poor man indeed. And yet at the same time, we have to keep in mind that in the flow of the thought of man, it opens the door for humanist man in a new way and carries this further and throws the doors wide open for all those problems that bring us right up into the period of modern man. Through history, the artists have done two things. They have reflected their culture, sometimes much more accurately than the writers, even the philosophers. And secondly, often they provide the way for the next step of this coming in culture. So sometimes they're a prophet, but always they're exhibiting that which is the culture of that day. The change that came with the Renaissance can clearly be observed in art. Up to that time, Florentine painting had been like Byzantine art, but even less polished, flat and without depth. And people were not portrayed realistically as real people. Then came Giotto, and with him, radical change. He was commissioned to paint the Last Judgment. And in it, he did a realistic portrait of his patron, Enrico Scrivini, a man who paid for the work. Nature was given its proper place. Proper, because nature is important as God made the world
and proper in the sense that nature is portrayed as it really is. On the other hand, these people are much too large for the scale of the world around them. Look at this bridge. How could this man fit into this observation platform or aim a bow and arrow out of this window? The same man who painted this designed the beautiful bell tower, the Campanile, next to the cathedral in Florence. A painter who creates buildings. We now come to a great breakthrough in Renaissance art. Masaccio, a friend of Brunelleschi, used real live faces in his work, which gave a lifelike quality to it, which was unique in his day. Painters who preceded Masaccio, including his own teacher, Masolino, painted their figures seemingly on tiptoe. Masaccio had the feet of his people planted firmly on the ground. Masaccio was first to consistently use central perspective. This was a clear step ahead of the Romans, who only knew a different kind of perspective. By painting in the round, and by the use of the new perspective, his people were in the midst of realized space. There was actually space around the people. But for the men of the Renaissance, it was something more. It placed man in the center of that space, a space subordinated to the mathematical principles that came out from the mind of man. In Northern Europe, Jean van Eyck wrestled with the same problems in art. We're in St. Bavo Cathedral in Ghent, in Belgium. The rich, the poor, all classes and kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds are coming to Christ. The artist appreciated and understood the biblical emphasis on Christ. He painted Christ as the Lamb of God, upright and alive upon the altar, symbolizing that he died as a substitute, a sacrifice, but that he is not now dead. According to Jesus' own words, "I am the living one who became dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Amen." Van Eyck mastered light and air and was the first great master of landscape painting. Here is a true portrait of nature. Nature has its proper place in the world which God has made. The writers wrote the way the painters painted. Dante, in whose house I am at Florence, was an early and ideal example of this. His work was genius at its highest level.
And the good master studying that train said, "Look there at that great soul that approaches and seems to shed no tears for all his pain. What kingliness moves with him even in hell? It is Jason, who by courage and good advice made off with a Colchian ram."
He made more room for nature, but following the influence of Thomas Aquinas, he mixed the Christian and the classical world. In his Divine Comedy,
the greatest sinners were Judas, who betrayed Jesus, and Brutus and Cassius, who betrayed Caesar. In his own life, the problem of individual things versus meaning and values was clearly demonstrated. He loved Beatrice, whom he actually only saw a couple of times in his life, and held up their love as the romantic ideal.
Seeing her face that is so fair to see, love shed such perfect sweetness over me.
But he married quite a different woman who never had any place in his poetry. Her business was to rear his children and to cook. Although the writers of the time understood that sensual love required the spiritual, if it was to be more than merely a physical response of the passing moment, yet nevertheless they allowed these two to be divided into two parts, the physical love and the idealized spiritual love. For Dante and the other writers of his time, they had two views of love. One, the idealized spiritual love directed toward a disembodied phantom, and the other, a dray horse of a woman who kept her man's house and shared his bed. This produced not beauty, but ugliness.
The Dome of Florence. Brunelleschi designed and built it. It brought together great artistic triumph with an overwhelming feat of engineering. What is especially overwhelming is that Brunelleschi was trained not as an architect, but as a goldsmith. This building, the Foundling Hospital, which you are now looking at, was also designed by Brunelleschi and was the first Renaissance building.
More emphasis was placed upon man. We know very little about those who built the Gothic cathedrals, or who wrote the Gregorian chants. But now the artist himself became important. Here is a biography of Brunelleschi, and some of his contemporaries wrote autobiographies. Sculptures, portraits, and even self-portraits of the artist began to be made.
At the beginning of the Renaissance, it could have gone either way. Nature could have had its proper place, man could have been in his proper place, and would have been absolutely beautiful. But at a certain point along in the Renaissance, the scales tipped, and man put himself at the center absolutely. And this opened the door completely to the whole destructive force of humanism that followed down through the Enlightenment and into our own day. Music was another large and important area in the time of the Renaissance.
The composers of the Renaissance invented the art of orchestration. Not only did each instrument play a different voice, but a different melody line. The North influenced the South not only in painting, but in music. String instruments of the Renaissance were built in matched sets so that the timbre was uniform from bass right through the soprano instrument. Music was printed with movable type for the first time. This is the lute, the most popular solo instrument of the Renaissance. The sackbut, like our trombone. the viol, ancestor of our viola, the crumb horn, and the spinet. Up to this time, things could have gone in one of two ways. There could have been an emphasis on real people living in a real world which God had made, in which all individual things had importance because God had made the whole world. Or humanism could have taken over with its emphasis on the individual things being autonomous. But the die was cast. Man made himself increasingly independent. He made himself his own measure. He tried to make himself autonomous. The humanistic man of the Renaissance thought of the time before him as something unsavory, something to be forgotten. To him, it was the Dark Ages. And he thought of his own age as a great leap forward into his own period of rebirth or Renaissance. A rebirth of the pre-Christian golden age of ancient Greece and Rome. Thomas Aquinas had opened the door for this with his emphasis upon the teaching of Aristotle. This is a fresco painted by Raphael in the Vatican. It is called the School of Athens. The central figures in this fresco are Plato and Aristotle. Raphael painted the hands of these two men to represent the philosophic emphases. Plato, with his finger pointing upward, emphasized absolutes, ideals, meaning, value. But Aristotle, with his hands spread downward, emphasized the individual things, the particulars, nature, man. But what is the meaning of particulars, including me and you, if they have nothing, no final thing to be related to, so that they have meaning? And how do we know concerning our individual acts, whether they're right or wrong, if there is no absolute to give us certainty?
The dilemma between any form of humanism and biblical Christianity, it really rests at the question of whether we have to begin from man alone as autonomous and then build everything from that, or whether there's truth from another source, which is an absolute truth and which therefore is not relative. Now, if we begin from the humanist truth, the view of truth, rather, they don't have truth, all it ends with is a matter of statistical averages. And then it leads to the place where humanism has brought us in our own generation.
Here is one example of this dilemma. Fouquet's Red Virgin. Fouquet's model was Agnes Sorel, who was the mistress of Charles VII, King of France. Was this the Madonna about to feed her baby? No. It might have had the title the Red Virgin, but those who looked at the painting at that time knew who the woman was. She was the king's mistress. Prior to this, Mary was considered high and holy. Even earlier, she was thought of as so different from normal people that she was painted merely as a symbol. Painting Mary as a real person was an advance over the earlier paintings, because the Bible tells us that Mary was a real girl and the baby Jesus was a real baby. This was the good side. Nature was given its proper place. On the other hand, the king's mistress could now be painted as Mary, and meaning was being destroyed. At first, it might seem that only religious values were being threatened, but gradually the threat spread to all of knowledge and all of life. All meaning for all the individual things, the particulars, was removed. The individual things were made independent, autonomous, with nothing ultimately to relate them to give them meaning.
We are now in the Academy in Florence, in a room given to Michelangelo's work. On either side, we see Michelangelo's statues called the Captives. These used to be called unfinished statues, but now many scholars agree that they were left to say what Michelangelo wanted them to say. Man is tearing himself out of the rock. Mankind will be victorious. As one passes these statues, we come to the focal point of the room. The magnificent statue of David. Out of a flawed piece of marble, Michelangelo, with all his genius, carved his David. A piece of art with few equals in the world. But this isn't the biblical David, but rather the personification of the humanist ideal, the greatness of man.
But toward the end of his life, there were signs that Michelangelo saw that humanism was not enough. There was and there is no man like David. It is thought that in the Pietà in the cathedral in Florence, he put his own face on Nicodemus as he was bending over Christ. Humanistic pride seems lessened, if not absent.
We now come to another great giant of the Renaissance, Leonardo da Vinci. He was the first modern mathematician, and he was a chemist, physicist, musician, architect, anatomist, botanist, mechanical engineer, and artist. He did studies of the human anatomy. Some could still be used in today's textbooks. He was the embodiment of the true Renaissance man. He could do almost everything and do it well. He designed war machines of savage atrocity. He designed the ball bearing. Leonardo really understood the problem of modern man. In his genius, he anticipated where humanism would end. He understood that humanistic man, beginning only with individual things, that is, the particulars, had no unity by which to give them meaning. He understood that beginning humanistically with mathematics, one is left with individual things. And having only individual things, one could never come to universals or to meaning. Instead, one is left with mechanics. And in this, he saw ahead to our own day, where even man is viewed as a machine. Then Leonardo thought that perhaps the painter, the sensitive man, could come to meaning. So he tried and tried to portray the soul. This is not a soul in the Christian sense. Rather, he was trying to capture visually the universals from the particulars he observed. He failed. We're back to Raphael's School of Athens. Aquinas' teaching led to man trying to be independent, autonomous, and this led to Renaissance humanism. Leonardo, in all his brilliance, felt the problem and struggled to find universals. Leonardo and all of humanism had been so sure that man, beginning only from himself, could solve every problem. Its cry was, "I can do what I will, just give me till tomorrow." But in his old age, Leonardo, in his brilliancy, saw the coming defeat of humanism. As a man thinketh, so is he. And humanism had already begun to show its natural conclusion was pessimism. When Francis I, King of France, took Leonardo to France, we find Leonardo in despondency.
Anybody who doesn't feel the beauty of the Renaissance as he walks through Florence, I feel, is a poor man. And I love to go to Florence and walk through the museums and just walk through the streets. But on the other hand, one who only sees the beauty and the glory of the Renaissance, in which man was increasingly making himself autonomous, if you don't feel the weakness of this, you also don't understand the Renaissance. Humanism invariably ends in despair. If you begin with that which is finite, no matter how far you project it, you can never come to an absolute. Never. In the light of the humanist dilemma, there is only one real solution: to turn to this book as truth. Turn to the Bible, not just as an abstract religious thing, but as truth. It doesn't change. It speaks to the culture of that particular day. It's never old-fashioned. It speaks to the most current topics. And yet it is always rooted in the same thing: the existence of this infinite personal God and his having spoken. And then, of course, for man's personal need in the death of Christ for him.
Well, when you hear things like particulars and universals, things like that, you can kind of get lost in it. But, you know, those are philosophical terms that are used to try to codify a concept. And those are good terms. I mean, those are terms that do express the issues of what's going on. What we would call reason and observation is the particulars. That is, man can try to determine everything about the universe by observing and in thinking about it. See, it starts from man. The biblical concept is that it starts from God. As God reveals to man what's really going on. If you've ever tried to delve into history, for example, and find out what's real true, is very difficult. Okay. And it's disputable. So what God did is he gave us a history book that is accurate. See, one that we can base our judgments on. And so the Bible, among other things, is a history book. It's the only objective history book ever written. All others are biased at some point in some way, in some fashion. Man needs God to give him direction. So when you begin with the particulars, that is, you're essentially saying, "I'm beginning with man." That's why it has the name humanism. See, it begins with man. and it's what man can perceive. Now, there is a book in the Bible that really discusses that whole issue. It's the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon. It's written from the perspective that this is all a person can know by the application of his reason and observation. Now, Solomon obviously was a smart man. And he could go to the end of the conclusion on that. And his conclusion was, all is vanity. You know, the preacher looked and he saw under the sun, all is vanity. That's why you have Leonardo da Vinci there sitting there, painted himself, drew himself, and he's drawn the conclusion that it's futile. All the philosophers go that direction when they reject the idea of God. Now, what was also going on at the same time were things that actually impacted religion quite a bit, and we'll get into that a little bit more next week. But the Catholic Church, because it had, in the words of Shakespeare, bestrode the world like a colossus, had really suppressed all thought. And so all dictums, all information, all perspectives came from the church and came from the church alone. Now, what the emphasis on particulars did is it began to set up the idea that a man could think for himself, and that a man could think outside the box. Now, for those who were interested in pursuing a better analysis of the Scripture, that was a good thing. But for most, like Da Vinci and others, it was a bad thing, because they just rejected the Bible as being a part of the Catholic dictum and went the direction that man can learn everything and understand everything himself. Now, the Renaissance, essentially, most people agree, really began and was centered in Florence, Italy. Florence is in the center section of Turkey, north of Rome. And if you were looking carefully at those buildings as they were kind of giving you a panorama, you could see some mountains behind them. Those are the Apennines. Okay, the Apennines is a central ridge that runs right down the center of Italy. And so that the river flowed out of the mountains and underneath those bridges. Florence wasn't the only place. Venice was another place where there's a tremendous amount. Raphael, for example. Many others had quarters in Venice. To some degree, Milan and many other places throughout the Po River Valley. Much of this was going on. One of the best books that I ever read taught me more about art than my art education courses did at the university. It's called The Agony and the Ecstasy. It was written by Irving Stone. It's about Michelangelo. Now, Michelangelo was a tremendous genius. Michelangelo was also homosexual, okay? And he lived to be a long time. He lived over 90 years old. And he produced a lot of his great stuff after he was 60. Okay? Now, you're wondering, well, why is the Catholic Church then in the process of financing paintings that glorify Aristotle and Plato? Well, it shouldn't surprise you, because the Catholic Church is a human and a humanistic organization. Now, let's turn our Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 4. Once in a while, we have to see certain things to remind ourselves of what's really going on. And there again, the Bible's of great value, because there's no human way to know these things. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1, he says, "But the Spirit explicitly says, in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons, by means of the hypocrisy of liars seared in their own consciences with a branding iron. Men who forbid marriage and advocate abstaining from foods which God has created to be gratefully shared in by those who believe and know the truth." Now, one of the organizations that you can see very clearly here are both what became the Greek and the Roman Catholic churches. Catholic Church, of course, is our focus because we're looking at that which went in the direction of the West. But it says the Spirit explicitly says that the Catholic Church is a result of the doctrines of demons and the lies of men who are hypocrites, whose conscience is just totally cut off and cauterized, seared. So what you have to remember behind all this, you've got the shadowy form of Satan himself working through those demonic influences, see, to produce things like the Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church is not biblical at all. You know, it has trappings of biblicism. You know, again, those stylized paintings of Mary, you see, that's a result of Catholic thought. And so you see the Virgin Mary, so to speak, looking like a symbol, representing something, not a human being. And of course, as he pointed out, you know, Mary was just as much a girl as any of the one of the girls in this room. Jesus was just as much a baby as any other baby that was ever born. Just happened to be the Holy Spirit living inside that body. But outwardly, you don't think Joseph and Mary walked around with these, you know, kind of yellow things around their head. You know, it's not how it was. But the Catholic Church set that up in order to, see, make God distant and make people need the priest. Had to go to the priest. So he couldn't go to God, had to go to the priest. That was all part of the setup. And part of what made that work was early on the incorporation of the Gnostic philosophies into Catholicism. And the Gnostics, of course, had the same philosophies of the Greek philosophers. So when he comes back and he points out that one of the things that the Renaissance did is it brought the classic, that is, it brought the Greek philosophy in, you're going to see a real emphasis of humanism, and you're not going to see the Catholic Church opposed to that at all. That's why the Catholic Church commissioned the painting of Aristotle and Plato. The agenda is the same. The shadowy hands behind it have one mental author. And so, as is typical, you have Satan setting up two things to herd the people into a corral. They've got, if they go the direct Catholic direction, they're going to be rushed into Satan's corral. If they go over and they start down the humanist side, as the Renaissance, the new birth guys, then they're going to get herded into Satan's corral too. Now, who financed? See, that's a question I always want to know. Who financed the Renaissance? Who financed all that stuff that was coming out of Florence? Anybody here even dare to take a guess of the family that would do that? You know. Go ahead, Gary.
Medici.
That's right. Medici? Okay, I pronounce it Medici, but hey, I haven't studied Italian. My name isn't DiPaolo. Okay, Medici, okay? Okay, now, I'm going to go ahead and pronounce it Medici, because if I don't, my tongue will stumble over itself. Okay. But the Medici family became the major bankers, and their banking interests controlled much of Europe. Okay, and so it was the Medici family that ended up financing the art and the development of the Renaissance and the development of the beginnings of the development of modern humanism. Now, see, these things you shouldn't be surprised at. The big money boys you can count on. Who do you think pays for all the art? Somebody's got to pay for it. You got some guy chipping away, you know, at a flawed block of marble for a couple of years. Somebody's got to pay that guy, especially a guy with that kind of talent. Okay. Now, we got it set up pretty well in our society where the National Endowment for the Arts pays for that, and so the taxpayers, pay for, pictures of Jesus painted, in a bottle of urine, that sort of thing. We pay for those things. Somebody's got to pay for it, so you always want to follow that money trail. Why do these things keep leading back to the bankers? See, that's the question you want to ask yourself. Let's go to James here. James chapter 2. You know, he's talking about the idea, if you got a rich guy and a poor guy that come into the assembly and you pay special attention to the rich guy and you kind of shove the poor guy off to the side, he said, you've become judges with evil motives. And he ends up asking a couple questions here in James chapter 2, which are significant. In verse 5, he said, listen, my beloved brethren. He said, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? The poor people don't have a lot of earthly stuff at stake. Okay, I mean, you know, a guy, if he's got a cottage and he's got two beds for a family of eight, a floor that's packed down enough so that it isn't too dusty, and he can feed and clothe it, then he doesn't have a lot at stake. You know, if he can have that and maintain that and live and die in peace, then the average man is pretty happy with that. Now, the rich guys, though, aren't quite so happy with that. Verse 6, he said, but you have dishonored the poor man. And I said, is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you've been called? Now, why would he pick on the rich here? See, why? And obviously, he's not talking about all the rich all the time. But why is that the general tendency? Now, there's a hint back here in James chapter 1. In verse 9, he said, but let the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position. Let the rich man glory in his humiliation, because like the flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. Catch this line. So too the rich man, in the midst of his pursuits, will pass away. That's what the rich do. They have their pursuits. They have the things that they want to do. If their name is Marquis de San, then they have a few pursuits that they want to engage in. All right? And that's been the history of the rich people, the gentlemen, the nobility. They have their pursuits. Now, they don't want preachers and teachers and Christianity coming along and tell them they can't have those pursuits. How many here read the Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas? Actually, read the book, okay? What's the moral standards of France, say, at the time of the Musketeers? Yeah. Down the tubes, okay? Now you think the French nobility going to be really excited about preachers and an emphasis on the Bible come along and tell them they can't have all those girlfriends on the side? You know that one picture, the Red Virgin? It's the king's mistress, right? That's typical. You think they want, in the midst of their pursuits, you think that they want somebody come along and tell us not right? You think King Herod liked it when John the Immerser said, it's not lawful for you to have Herodias as your wife? You think he liked that? You think Herodias liked it? See, now the Bible records these things for our benefit. So Herodias was so torqued at John the Immerser that she actually set up a pretty involved manipulation scheme to make sure that John's head was separated from the rest of his body. And she knew her husband really well. She knew his birthday was coming up. And so she arranged for her daughter basically to do a belly dance at the birthday party, knowing that the old goat would go out of his head and could be persuaded to give up just about anything. And, of course, everything went exactly according to plan. And when the girl gets done, he says, I'll give you whatever you want up to half of my kingdom. And she says, I want the head of John the Immerser on a platter, right? See, I mean, who was the real brains of this operation here? Okay. See, but why did Herodias want John killed? Why did she want him out of the picture? See, she didn't want him standing there saying, "It's not lawful for you. It's not lawful for you to pursue your ambition." See, what she did, she dropped her previous husband, Philip, and attached herself to Herod because she thought his political star was rising faster. And she liked little trips to Rome, you know, shopping sprees at the mall. And so she did that. See, when the preacher says, when the Bible says, when truth says, you can't do that, that's wrong, then we get pretty violent because nobody is going to tell us what we can and what we can't do. Now, if that sounds like humanism to you, it is. The rich over the history of the world have had the finances and the resources to be able to be pleasers of self, to do what they want when they want it. And they've had the finances and the political pull power so that they themselves could override justice, have justice applied to other people, but they themselves would not have to be hauled into the courts. When the Bible comes along and it says every man's accountable to God, when the Bible comes along and says, look at their standards of right and wrong, when the Bible comes along and said, here's justice right here, and like in the book of Deuteronomy, for example, it says, hey, you don't give a guy special privileges because he's poor. And he said, you don't take a bribe from the rich. See, lest those things blind you. You treat them alike under the law. Those are the standards of justice that the Bible sets up. So the rich then have always been those who've opposed it. See, in James chapter 5, verse 1, he said, come now, you rich, weep in hell for your miseries which are coming upon you. See, your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted. The rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fires in the last days that you stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, Lord of hosts. You've lived luxuriously on the earth, led a life of wanton pleasure. You fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. You've condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. That's how it's always been. Now, how do you think the rich like the book of James? Your gold and your silver rusted. Rust is going to consume your flesh like fire. See, this, I mean, these are pictures here that's being painted, once again, for our benefit, so that we try to can see the world as it really is. So we can see it as God sees it. We can see what's underneath the surface. See underneath the veneer, you know, the stuff, the whitewash that's painted over the wall. So we can see those things. So we understand better what's going on. So the art, as he points out, is always a great reflection of the thought processes and the attitudes and the perspective and the worldview of the people. Who are the patrons of the art? How many of you guys here financed a big art project lately? Nobody? See, who are the patrons of the art? It's the rich guys. Now, what if the painter doesn't paint what the patron wants? Doesn't get paid. Okay. Doesn't get paid. Something in Micah. Micah chapter 7, if my memory is correct. Micah chapter 7, verse 3. It says, concerning evil, both hands do it well. Okay, now listen to these words. I'm going to Now pay attention to these words. The prince asks, also the judge, for a bribe. And a great man speaks the desire of his soul. Now, who do you think the great man is? That's your rich guy. And that's the guy that's financing the operation. So, they weave it together. The Medici family basically perpetrated, through the Queen Mother of France, the destruction of the Protestant movement in France in the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, August 24th, 1572. On that day, at least 100,000 Huguenots. Huguenots is the name for the French Protestants. On that day, at least 100,000 Huguenots were butchered in a night. Maybe upwards of 500,000 before it was all over. And the result is the Bible left, in any sense at all, the Bible left France at that day. Now, the Huguenots, you know, were basically scattered everywhere. Some went to South Africa. Some went to Northern Ireland. And just a little ways north of Belfast, there was a guy by the name of Thomas Campbell, a good Presbyterian minister, who married a Huguenot gal by the name of Jane Cornagle. And Thomas and Jane became the parents of a guy named Alexander Campbell. So it gives you an idea of where these things go. But when the Huguenots left France, they took the Bible with them. And so France is totally spiritually bankrupt from that time on, as it is to this day. Significant. Now, the Medici family were the ones that orchestrated that. But the Medici family themselves had difficulty because one of the things that they did, they're so interested in the development and the pursuit of humanism that they neglected some of their banking responsibilities. And they made a major mistake. The big men, the great men, do these things. That's why it says the prince asked for a bribe here out of Micah 7. One thing about kings or governments, they always spend more than they take in taxes. So what happens then is the bankers loan money to kings. Now the Medici family made the same mistake that the Knights Templars had of a couple generations earlier, and they loaned money to the king of England, in this case Edward IV. And when Edward IV became embroiled in internal politics and the War of Roses developed, then he was unable to repay the Medici family. And we're talking, you know, shall we say millions here in gold. What the Medici family tried to do then is they tried to get a lock on on the sheep. See, the wool for the weavers in Italy came from England. It was by far the best wool. And so what the Medici family did is they tried to get a lock on that wool in order to try to collect. They were unable to do so. The king wouldn't allow them to do it. So the Medici family bank went down because they loaned way too much money out that then they couldn't collect. When that collapsed, of course, that had a huge impact on the Renaissance and some of the things that the Medici family had financed. But of course, by this time, several hundred years had passed, and Europe was ready for the next phase of its history. Now, did anybody notice in today's paper that the Federal Reserve and some of the other banks are beginning to make some moves to shore up the mortgage and housing industry? Anybody notice that? Yeah. No. History has its tendency to repeat itself, and so you want to pay attention to these things. The reason the art reflects the worldview of the times, because the art is financed by the money boys. And the artists are going to paint and produce and sculpt what the guys paying for it want. And they are able to impose their worldview in any given time on their people. And that's why the eventual discovery of what was called the New World was such a tremendous blessing, because people could break loose from the tremendous oppression that had occurred on the European continent. And there's actually a new beginning of which you and I are the beneficiaries. But they were squished in Europe and couldn't get out from underneath, because those who added land to land and house to house had a lock on the people. Closing questions or thoughts or comments that anybody wants to throw in? Ken.
Yeah, I lost it with the when you're talking about the prime mortgage.
Oh.
Okay, we're bailing them out, so what's the consequence?
Well, you can only bail out so long, and then what happens?
Then our economy's going in the...
Yep. Pretty hard to have a house of cards stand forever. But history repeats itself, so you keep seeing these things. Rain and then Rick.
We're just going through the book of Deuteronomy, and one of the things that we come across at our breakfast table this morning was, it seems like in the Old Testament, is if Israel had their focus right on God, then Israel dictated government. And it says here in Deuteronomy 16:18, "You shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you. According to your tribes, they shall judge the people with righteousness, with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous."
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, what I've long noticed is that there's a core philosophy that is buttressed by humanism, or not by humanism, but evolution. And usually people think of evolution, they think of, you know, evolving a man, science. But what is subtly, I mean, it's done in the philosophy department, but it permeates through the whole intelligentsia, the university system, and into society. It's sort of an unspoken but understood thing that human nature has changed because of evolution. So evolution is primarily a philosophy, a religion. And so when you start talking about the nature of man hasn't changed, and you start bringing in the Bible, then for the bulk of society, it's just like so much water off the duck's back, because they've been subtly and covertly taught that human nature is changing, when in fact it hasn't. So they tend to trust leaders and don't realize what's going on.
Yeah, you should trust the Führer. Yeah. But see, that's actually the philosophy Rick's talking about, is exactly what they've produced in Germany to get people to trust, you know, Ayn Rand, you know. So these things are important, okay? So pay attention to them. What you'll get out of this as we go along, you'll see how then these forces at work through the art and the music of our own time to produce a worldview that is, you know, hostile to Christianity. And we have to be aware of it, understand how we got there.